Can you say something?
Yeah, I can say whatever you want me to say. Check, check, tick, tick, boom.
Oh, it's perfect.
That's just because it's me.
Well.
I just want to say that I'm glad that we're here because you scared me on Tuesday.
Wednesday.
Was it Wednesday?
If you're talking about what I'm talking about.
When you sent me the text message saying we weren't doing a podcast anymore?
Right.
Because here's the thing. The way you said it was, like, not cryptic, but just not very... You weren't really explaining it. And so I get a text message from you, and it just says, well, I guess we're not doing the podcast anymore. And I said, why? What happened? You go, yet another loss. And here's what I thought. Because you recently told me that your hours got cut.
Yes.
And so when you said another loss...
You thought I got fired.
Yeah, or laid off or whatever, so we didn't have access to the studio.
Nice.
And I was just in my head like, oh, man, I'm going to have to start inviting her over to the house, which means Lee's going to make me clean more.
Why don't you just clean more often for funsies?
I am tired.
Is it because you're getting older and you're a dad?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's more because I'm a dad. You know, another thing I was thinking about, I was using the restroom before we got started. Like I do every time I go in there and I pee.
Right.
Because I don't want to have to do it during the show.
But sometimes you do.
Of course. Yeah. I have a baby bladder. But I was noticing like radio doesn't have money anymore.
Right.
So that restroom has not changed since the 80s.
Early 80s.
And that was a cool time to be alive in radio. Because it was rock and roll, and it was partying.
Yeah, you weren't paying for anything in town.
And I was just like, how much cocaine was snorted off of this sink? Because it's not glass, but it's like polished porcelain or marble, right? And it's just like, you know, the DJs were out all night long and coming in at 5 o'clock in the morning to start their morning show. I bet you there's one or two of them that still work here.
I have heard stories about particular promoters who wanted to get their artists on air, and so they would ask them, do you want hookers or blow?
Both. There's a great meme that's like a picture of a little girl, and it just says, why not both? And that's all. When someone gives me an option, I'm just like, let's do both. Obviously not now. But a long time ago, about 3 years ago.
Back in the Stone Ages.
Yeah, back when I was still working at the Comedy Store in Los Angeles, I would have been like, let's just negotiate a little of both.
So then for you, for both, you'd be like, yes, I'd like to clean the house and watch the child while giving you a massage.
Oh, God, that's three things.
So we got to keep it to two?
It's a lot, yeah.
So just clean the house and watch the kid?
She'd probably rather have the massage.
Fair.
And then she could do one of the other two things. See, I thought about saying what both of them would be misogynistic for me to say. So I was like...
Really, there's not a way to get out of this.
That's not
misogynistic.
Oh, man. But here's the good thing. I live in Texas, so you can be misogynistic.
Right. It's expected.
And that is probably the best thing about being...
Stuck in Texas.
Oh, yeah. We did it.
Seemed almost natural.
Anyway, this is like episode...
15.
Really?
Yep.
You know what? We messed up. Because I was going to ask you a question.
Two.
When we got to episode 13, that's not a lucky number.
Right.
And like if you build a tower that has an elevator, you go from 12 to 14.
Right.
And I was going to ask you if we should skip episode, like number it a different number. So here's what I'm going to say. We have not released that episode yet. Let's just say this is episode 16. And I'll go back, and when I release it, it'll be episode 14, and then 15, and then 16.
So you don't believe in ghosts, but you're a big pussy about the number 13.
First of all, I'm a big pussy about everything.
I lived in an apartment building, a mid-rise, and I lived on the 14th floor, which was the 13th floor.
How'd it go?
I mean, I'm still here.
Yeah, but how's your life?
to be honest, though... I did have to call for a welfare check on one of my neighbors, and they were 100% dead.
Oh, my gosh. That is traumatic.
I was like, his alarm clock's been going off for 2 days. Do you think something's wrong?
He was probably a DJ in the 80s.
A really deep sleeper.
So what are we doing first today?
Well, we say, what are we doing first today? But it's always Billy.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's been that way for like 10 episodes.
Oh, you know what? I just always assume that we're alternating and you're keeping track of it.
100%. It's Billy. Billy this week, and then next week it'll be Billy, and the week after that it'll be...
Okay, I got it.
Billy.
Well, I wasn't really sure what we were going to talk about, but something happened today.
Oh, gosh, okay.
And it is a very special day in every parent's life.
She got her period.
No, not yet. Hopefully she's about 12 years away from that. No, she said her first cuss word.
Was it a good one?
It was shit, which I think is probably every kid's first cuss word, unless you're Richard. And then the other day she said, oh, God, which to him is about the same.
It's worse. He doesn't care if you say shit.
Oh, okay. There you go.
So my daughter's first cuss word was fuck.
Boy, that's a big one.
Mostly because she couldn't get the t on
truck.
So we used to go to the playground and play near the fire station because every time she would see a fire engine, she'd go, fire fuck, fire fuck. And really when your life is just spent taking care of children, it's the little things like seeing a little toddler mouth go, fire fuck. That keeps you going.
Firefuck is what you call having sex with someone that has chlamydia.
Gross.
Because it burns when you pee.
Are you speaking from firsthand experience?
No, not at all. It's just what I heard.
How many antibiotics have you taken in your life?
A lot, but not for that.
Oh, okay, so it was just the gonorrhea?
I think my grandmother who raised me had Munchausen syndrome by proxy because I went to the doctor a lot.
She wanted to make sure you made it.
Yeah, that's probably it. I think the word truck is one of those words for kids that they're always going to say something else. Billy would say cuck.
Which meant nothing when my kid was her age.
Right, but it means a lot now. So every time she sees a guy driving a truck, she's calling him a cuck. She's like, cuck, cuck. And it's like, you know what? I think even though we left when you were 6 months old, you spent too much time in Los Angeles. And it got in here. There's nothing wrong with driving a truck. Doesn't mean that you like somebody else to have sex with your wife.
You don't have to make those assumptions.
Today, I had like just woken up and I went downstairs and I can't remember why I said it, but I was like sitting down and I was like, oh shit. And she was like standing right in front of me. And I'm telling you, I saw something in her head and I knew it was coming. And she just goes, shit. And I looked up at Lee because Lee was in the room and I go, she just did it. And she was like, what? I said, she said a cuss word. She said, did she say shit? That, by the way, try to say that three times. She says shit.
She says shit. She says shit. She says shit. Shit.
And I was like, yeah, I guess like this is the moment. We got to start watching what we say. And then Lee goes, ah, fuck. And then Billy said her second cuss word.
So for me with shit, we were living in D.C. and I was driving and I missed my exit and I had no idea how to get back to my apartment building if I missed my exit. So I was like, shit. And from the back seat, I hear shit, shit, shit. And I go, that's right. When we're in the car, we sit, sit, sit.
You tried to cover it up.
And like an hour and a half later, I found my way back to my apartment building.
Look, here's the thing. You're teaching them context. You don't just, I messed up. I said shit for some very, like I can't even remember why. But you said it because you missed an exit that was going to add an hour onto your life. And that's a good lesson to learn. You got to teach them when it's appropriate to cuss.
To be fair, if I didn't have Waze, that would be every day of my life.
We have become very dependent on it. I remember you used to just ask people like how to get somewhere and they'd be like, drive up to here, take a right, do this, take a left. I used to go into gas stations and all the time. If I was on a long trip, I'd ask people, how do you get to here? And they'd tell you. And if you ask somebody how to get to somewhere now, they'd be like, let me pull up my phone real quick.
Right.
It's funny because with Waze, it can sometimes be dangerous. You know, Waze will be like, you need to go up to the interstate and jump across the median and then drive through the cemetery and then take a left at the crosswalk. It's
right. And taking lefts at crosswalks is so difficult.
With Billy, though, I just a little bit more. She's about 23 months. She's almost two. She's about a month and a half away. And she is a day away from just talking. Because she has learned everything. When we went outside, she didn't have her shoes on, but there was a pair of shoes left outside. And I said, we got to get our shoes. And she saw those, but they're wet. They got left out. She was like, shoes. And I go, not these. And then she goes, not these. That's why when I said that cuss word, I just knew it was coming, because she is a sponge now.
And she's parroting.
She's parroting. She's comprehending as well. Like, that's the fun part for me, is when she says something, she knows. Like, we have this little stuffed animal named Pinky.
I know that, Stuffy.
And she cannot be without Pinky when she goes to nap. Well, we left it at home one day, and it made it difficult for her to sleep at the babysitter. So the babysitter ordered another Pinky.
Oh, how fun.
And when I took her next time, she had her Pinky, but then the Pinky was there. And she goes, two Pinkies, two Pinkies. And she would just walk around with both of them, being like, two Pinkies, two Pinkies. And so, like, she understands small numbers. Like, she'll help me feed the dogs, and it's three scoops, and she'll just be like, one, two, three. When she's going to jump, I'll have her count to three before. Like, it's finally at a state. Like, it's been fun this whole time. But now it's getting to this remarkable
hookers
point.
And blue fun now.
No, that is not. Oh, no.
That's in a while?
There's nothing that compares to that. But no, it's just at this remarkable point where I'm seeing her just become a person. And I know, like, it sounds silly. People, like, listening are going to be like, yeah, she said not these. Like, that's not a big deal. But when you held something in your arms that was completely incapable of doing anything, like, couldn't hold its own head up.
Right.
And now, just 2 years later,
you're sober, and you can hold your own head up.
I wasn't talking about me.
Damn it.
But it can communicate with you. It has a personality. Like, this is a real person that is developing in front of your eyes. It is amazing. I never really thought about it before, and I was always putting off becoming a parent because I wanted to be successful in comedy before I did it. And then I got in a relationship with a much older woman, and so time was running out.
Yeah, tick tock, tick tock.
And so we had the child. It's like, man, I wish I would have known this a long time ago, because, I mean, I'm glad that I didn't, because this child is perfect. But I would have loved to have already done this with her years ago.
I think that's a very interesting point that you're bringing up, because, like, I'm looking at it right now with my daughter, and she's like, I don't ever want to have kids. I don't ever want to whatever. And I'm like, you know, that's cool if that's your choice. But all she can see right now are the selfish reasons not to have a child.
And I went through it myself. Yeah, for sure. You're like, I can't go to Las Vegas on a whim. You can't do anything on a whim when you have a kid. You got to make plans. Sometimes things happen where those plans get canceled. It's like everything now in your life revolves around the child. So her thinking that absolutely makes sense.
It's legit.
Yeah. Who knows? I'm not going to say definite, but who knows? She, you know, times change people, and perhaps in like 10 years, she's going to be a little less selfish of her life and time.
Would you like to hear why I'm holding out hope that Rose may someday reproduce?
Yeah, I'd love to know.
For her 18th birthday, she was going away to college. She had a really old iPhone, and so we wanted to get her a new phone to take off to college so she could have something that was reliable and had more storage and all that stuff. So for her birthday, we take her into the cell phone store, and she was just spouting some internet woke shit about, I don't want an iPhone, iPhones suck, and I want an Android, and Android, 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 blah, 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 blah.
And you're like, I can't track your every movement on an Android.
So we go in there, and she's looking at all the phones. And at the end, she just sheepishly goes, oh, I want the iPhone. And I'm like, okay, you can have whichever phone you want. I don't really care. And then inside I'm going, she can change her mind.
Yeah, it won't definitely happen, but it's a good possibility that you're going to be a grandma one day.
Right. I'm pretty sure it will happen. I have had two children, so I've got like a backup in case she doesn't choose to reproduce.
And at least if it's your son that you have to rely on, it'll carry on the family name, which is what really matters.
That's it. That's the only thing that matters.
We have to live throughout time through our descendants.
You know that this is not my family name. I actually old school took my husband's name when we got married.
Yeah, that's the name that matters. Your husband's name.
Okay.
Remember, we're in Texas.
You're right. They're going to name the kid Kelly.
Whether it's a boy or a girl?
Do you know that my mom told me that she got the name Kelly out of the boy names?
What? There's a celebrity I feel like that's named Kelly.
Kelly Clarkson?
No, that's a boy or a man, actually.
I'm sure there are. I don't really know. Yeah, I'm not into all that celebrity stuff. I hardly pay attention to gossip or current events.
That's because you're a celebrity yourself.
Yeah, such a celebrity.
You're the work time DJ. What do they refer to your time slot?
It's called midday, 9 to 2.
It doesn't have like a cool, because like you have the afternoon drive, morning radio. It's not the, isn't it something like the workforce?
Well, we call it the bare workforce. That's how we refer to our fans during this day part.
Yeah, there you go. That and all the criminals.
We're also very blue collar. You know, we talked last week about the blue collar comedy tour.
That's right.
We are a very blue collar demographic that our radio station goes out to.
And this week we're talking about the Kings of Comedy. And probably indeed. A lot of the fans of Kings of Comedy are not listening to this radio station.
They're listening to our next door studio who has an urban station, yes.
I don't know if urban is the phrase. I know I'm getting old. I don't know if I'm allowed to say certain things to describe things. I don't know if urban is now frowned upon. But here's what I do know. There was a lot of things said in the Kings of Comedy special.
The whole time I was watching that special, I was thinking back to you and how, like, I don't know, pussy ass hurt you got about the spa segment and how that was just shouldn't have ever happened. And I'm watching this shit and I'm going, ooh, I wonder if Mitch is going to bring this up, that this would never happen today.
100%. Yeah.
And let's start with things that would never happen today. Can I just say Steve Harvey's suit?
What are you talking about? Do you watch Family Feud?
Yeah.
He wears a suit all the time.
Right, but not that hideousness that he was wearing there.
I don't know. He was fly, if you ask me. Which I'm sure that's how a lot of people described it back then.
I'm pretty sure that is a word from the time.
Can you describe the suit? It was...
Okay, there were a couple of things that were really weird.
Well, hold on. We need to set it up a little... Because some people might not have seen it. First of all, I want to talk about the years, okay? So, the Blue Collar Comedy Tour came out in 2003. The original Kings of Comedy came out in 2000. So it's quite possible that someone saw
the Kings of Comedy
and was like, we can do this for
the Everyman,
for the Blue Collar Comedy Tour.
Right. That was directed by Spike Lee, which seemed like quite an out there credit for him.
I also wanted to see, is it possible that it was produced by the same person? Because that one was produced by some guy named Latham. And I was curious if he was involved with the other one, because I could have swore that I saw his name at the beginning of the... It just looked familiar. But regardless, yeah, so the Kings of Comedy came out first. And you look at the venue that they're playing, it must have... It was huge.
Huge. It was gigantic, yes.
It's funny, because I guess all of these guys were like rock stars on their own. But... God, I was 20 when it came out, and I think everything that I knew about black culture, I learned through that comedy special. So it's Steve Harvey.
Right.
D.L. Hughley.
Right.
Cedric the Entertainer.
And Bernie Mac.
And then Bernie Mac. Now, go ahead and let's hear your thoughts on it. You had started saying some stuff, and then I cut you off.
That's okay. What do you want to talk about? Want to talk about Steve Harvey?
Well, yeah. Oh, we were talking about a suit.
Right. Well, I thought all of the suits were pretty hideous. And I was around in 2000, and I don't remember the suits being that bad. So to start with Steve Harvey's, you know, think about when you wear a sports jacket that the bottom of the coat maybe comes to about the palm of your hand, mid-palm.
Right, okay.
His was like several inches after the tip of his fingers.
Okay.
It was so super long, it actually had a button at the bottom that came across and held it together. Then the pants were an extraordinarily wide-cut leg. The coat was cut so tight that it had a vent pleat in the back of it between the shoulders so that his arms could cross. Very, very odd tailoring.
But obviously, it was like custom tailored for
absolutely,
his body.
For sure. And then D.L. Hughley, he's not a big guy. And the shoulders on his suit were probably 2 inches wider.
You remember shoulder pads?
I do.
That is, it was mostly on women's clothing. Do women's clothing, does it even come with shoulder pads anymore?
Sometimes they will have a shoulder pad in like a tailored coat, but it's going to be very thin. And what it does is it just sort of eases out, like where your collarbone comes together.
Uh-huh.
It's just meant to just ease that transition. It's like nipple guards for your shoulders.
Okay, nipple guards.
So D.L. Hughley, his jacket was really wide. Cedric the Entertainer, he was wearing a shirt and a vest thing that kind of made him look like Black Amish.
His sketch. So, do you remember Cedric used to have a commercial where he was talking about accessorizing?
No.
Let me pull it up real quick.
Okay. So, Cedric the Entertainer, he was wearing a shirt and a vest, and it kind of made him look Black Amish. And I thought the man was just morbidly obese in this. And normally, when you look at somebody in tailored clothes, they are very flattering. When I saw him in regular street clothes, I'm like, he's not nearly as fat as he looked on stage.
It is funny because maybe that led to him becoming fat because he did get bigger throughout the years.
Bernie Mac, I liked his suit. So let's break it down. Starting off, Steve Harvey, he's the one who hosted it.
You know what I thought was interesting about that is he also does a set in the middle, a longer set.
He does two sets in the middle.
Oh, he does.
He does the opening set.
Yep.
Then D.L. Hughley comes out. He does the second one that he does is very physical. It's about music, and it's great. And that's before Cedric.
Is that the one where he talks about the Titanic? Oh, no. Oh, it's the one where he's going along with the music. Yeah, here's what I thought about, too. How much money, like how much of the budget was dedicated to audio? Because you can't just use music freely in an act. You have to pay for the rights of that.
Right.
And there was a lot of music, even just the intro of Cedric coming out to Master P, or Mystical, I think it was.
I would imagine that they were able to, like Spike Lee was able to talk to artists and representation and be able to say, hey, listen, we really want to use all black artists and we want to do this, we want to do that and, you know, work with us.
Yeah.
But maybe not. Who knows?
All right. So Steve's second set is with the music.
Very
it's
physical.
Like
he's like being the Temptations. And I laughed my ass off when he was like doing a rock. And then he also did a rap concert. And then before Bernie Mac comes out, he does his third small set as a host. And it was about church and what have you.
Which one does he do the Titanic part in? Because I thought that was a really smart.
It's the first one.
Okay, so that act out, he utilizes a lot of the stage. First of all, I don't want to say everything, but a lot of stuff is what black people would do differently. And if black folks would have been on that ship, how they would have survived.
Right.
And he's talking about like flipping tables over and standing, and there's a table on the stage. And
other reason than that.
Well, a lot of times, if you perform in a comedy club, there will be a table.
Or a stool.
Because you want to put your drink on it or whatever. So I'm sure that as he was coming up, he utilized whatever was on the stage and did the same thing.
For sure.
But he turns the table over, and then he stands on the table, and then he acts out holding up a napkin and blowing on it to use it like a sail. And like, I forgot a lot about this special. And I forgot how physical Steve, because when you see him, first of all, he's also pretty vulgar. I find it amazing that he is the host of a daytime talk show.
Yep.
He's the host of the Family Feud. He has become this family-friendly guy that is giving advice on the proper ways to live your life and stuff. And you watch the Kings of Comedy, and it's just like, you know, what a transition.
Well, when I think about, you're talking about how physical he is, I think back to the first time he was on Showtime at the Apollo, and he did this skit where this boxer who was from that area, he had been hit in the face so hard and his eye was super swelled up, and he did this thing where he comes out and he's doing the whole skit from the perspective of the eye.
You're putting your hand in front of your eye and acting like it's like a swollen eye. The audience couldn't see that.
Yeah, I'm just imitating what Steve Harvey did on his first go at it.
Right.
When he first was on Showtime at the Apollo. That was his first set that he did live on TV that I can remember.
And you know what's funny is if you came out and flipped a table over and stood on it and stuff like that, and if you did that at an open mic in Los Angeles, people would say you're the hackiest comedian there. But at this point in time, first of all, we weren't as critical of comedy. If shit made you laugh, it made you laugh.
Right.
And you know what's funny is another thing I was going to bring up about Steve, you just said his first Showtime at the Apollo, he's talking about a guy, a local boxer.
Right.
Hosting this huge event in Charlotte, North Carolina.
That's his open.
His opening was all about Charlotte.
Right.
And so that, you know, he might have been picked as the guy to host because of his ability to just get the crowd I thought the crowd on this one was way more into it than Blue Collar Comedy Tour.
Oh, for sure.
Right? Like, this audience, I almost said these people, which, wrong audience to refer to as these people. This audience was dying the entire time. These guys were crushing.
Every time music would come up, half of the audience would be standing and just doing their own dance, and it was spectacular. There was just so much energy in that room.
Yeah, and it starts with Steve Harvey.
And going back, I want to start with what Steve Harvey's opening line was, is God is everything. And that just, to me, one of the things that I'm personally trying to balance is the fact I am a Christian. I have complete love and faith in my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Also, I think shitting on the side of the road is funny.
I bet while your husband was pooping on the side of the road, you know, God was looking down and being like, I made that happen. That's funny.
Something else I thought was interesting about Steve Harvey's opener was something that can't happen anymore. He used the R word as the complete R word repeatedly.
A bunch of times. R word referring to people who have mental drawbacks.
Ray.
But he wasn't the only one.
No, it came out. It came out a lot. It seemed to be something that was topically humorous.
Oh, yeah, for sure. For sure. And then maybe like 5 years later, it was like, you cannot say this anymore. But they were at the peak R word usage.
And before Bernie Mac came on, something I thought was hilarious is the hack culture in those four was such that they went to a major radio station in Charlotte, I'm assuming, to talk about the show just right, to promote it. And instead of actually taking off their brimmed hats, the men would take their headphones. One of them had them under his chin like this. Another one of them had them so behind the neck.
One of them had it, was wearing their headphones like a chin strap on a football helmet.
Yep.
And the other one had it behind his
neck. Like a necklace.
Or like the travel pillows.
Yes, it was a travel pillow that made sound.
You know what,
sure.
I think about with that is how great it must be to go into a radio station and be able to have headphones waiting for you.
I know. That's the difference between a major market in a small town.
Just wish I had some headphones. Some cans, as they call them in the biz.
I've got cans here and here.
Oh, God. She just pointed to her boobs.
Boobs. All right. So that was Steve Harvey's first set. Do you want to do all Steve Harvey sets, or do you want to go into D.L. Hughley?
I mean, let's just go into D.L.
Okay.
So
he came out and he talked about job quitting, the difference between black people and white people, which is something that Steve Harvey had already brought up in his Titanic skit coming as the opener.
I mean, he definitely, again, something that you don't see a lot of comics doing anymore is black people do this, white people do that. Look, these guys did it, and no one's ever going to do it better than they did.
It's true.
And The thing that I will say, I don't know how beneficial some of it was. I don't know how beneficial some of it was to black culture, because he's using a lot of negative stereotypes against black people, and then he's saying a lot of things picking on white people that are actually
complimenting,
you know, good things that we do. So if like a white guy would have been saying this stuff, it would have been like, this guy, like, you can't, why is he being so racist?
It's like race deprecation.
Instead of self-deprecation?
Yes.
Yeah.
But I will tell you, so my husband grew up really poor and in trailer parks. So
he even got a job at Long John Silver's just because he couldn't afford to eat there.
Yeah, you gotta work towards your dreams, right?
He's had three jobs, and I think it's funny that that one is actually listed on his jobs on Facebook. He's so proud of that job at Long John Silver's.
He worked so hard. It's where he began to, you know, understand how to negotiate with people, because they would make up extra fish at the end of the night and do trades. They would negotiate trades with other area restaurants so that they could have some pizza. Yeah.
I didn't know that. Like, and nowadays, they consider that stealing, and they just throw it away.
Shenanigans.
Corporate BS, if you ask me.
So I'm watching this last night with Richard, and his family, you know, maybe sometimes had a phone, maybe didn't, you know. Utilities would often go off, mostly mm-hmm. because the money was spent on Budweiser, the king of beers, rather than on electricity or gas.
Yeah, I mean, if they would have just drank Natty Ice,
they could have had it both ways. They could have had cakeism.
I was listening to this, and I immediately was like, I think DL knows a different group of white people than I did growing up.
And that's what Richard said. He goes, this isn't black versus white. This is just poor people stuff.
It's interesting, because if we go back to Blue Collar, I don't think a lot of black people watched it. I don't know. Like, my wife is white, but she grew up in a predominantly black city, went to a predominantly black school, and so she saw the Kings of Comedy, but she's never watched Blue Collar Comedy Tour. It just wasn't appealing to a lot of black people. But Kings of Comedy, pretty much everybody watched it, and I think that's why. Even though D.L. Hughley is talking about black people and white people, there's a lot of poor-ass white people that were like, nah, I get it.
Richard was laughing from his intestines, and it wasn't at black culture for being this way. He's like, that's not black culture. That's my culture.
When he's talking about they messed up because they gave black people caller ID, and they're like, let it ring, let it ring. I don't know why. Like, I didn't think we were poor, but there were a few bills that my grandparents were definitely behind on, and we had caller ID. And if I went to pick it up, I would, like, get in trouble. It was like, no, you let that go to the answering machine. Don't you pick up that phone, not until the first of the month, or not
Perfect.
Until payday, you know, whatever.
So D.L. Hughley did something that you got on to Bill Engvall in the last special for doing, which is he did the Chinese accent with the bill collector.
Yep.
And it was bad.
I forgot about that. Because he's talking about, at some point, you just become honest with them, and they're like, you need to pay us the money. And you're like, I ain't paying you no money because I ain't got no money. Quit calling here because I'm tired of pretending that I ain't here. And then he does the accent saying he's not there, and he goes, I ain't Chinese. And it really was, it was like the most offensive Chinese accent.
It was not good.
But again, saying the R word in the beginning, and then DL doing the Chinese accent, it was like, you know, it's 20-something years ago, but, you know, it wasn't as offensive to people back then. I'm sure there were a lot of Asian people watching that going, like, that's not what I sound like.
Now, my favorite thing about D.L. Hughley was that his crowd work was just roasting the shit out of the audience.
So I found that interesting, because you'd think if you was going up on a big tour like this, you would want to be doing your best prepared material.
I was thinking the same thing.
But D.L. was, maybe that was like something that he just excelled at. Also, he was mean.
Right. It was not nice stuff.
And these thousands of people were just eating it up. They were like, yeah, get them. Take them down. But it's funny because they all did. And I think the reason is, and I hate to sound like I'm just saying, like, you know, this is how a group of people behave or whatever.
Which means you're just about to tell me how a group of people behaves?
Yes. Black audiences expected more. Like, if you watch Showtime at the Apollo, they, like, start booing and pointing people off the stage, and then the Sandman comes out with the hook and takes... So, you know, I think that coming up and working black rooms and having predominantly black audiences, these guys had to take them down. You know, we haven't gotten to Bernie Mac yet, but if you watch his first TV appearance on Def Comedy Jam, they were booing somebody prior to him, and he just comes out and he's like, I ain't scared of you motherfuckers. And then he says that over and over and over. So these guys have come up in a very aggressive audience kind of environment. And so, you know, they come out, Steve Harvey's like, Charlotte, this, like, you know, I'm country as hell too. He's from West Virginia, you know, and then D.L. Hughley, and he's just roasting the shit out of some people in the front of the room.
I thought it was interesting that he did that at the end of his set as opposed to the beginning of his set.
Here's why I think. Because it was kind of mean, so he's got to win them over. If he just came out and started shitting on the audience, people would think that was, you know, maybe mean or too aggressive or whatever. So I think he just comes out, wins them over, and then he's like, you know what, now let's have some fun. Let's go off script, and I'm going to hit everybody right here.
All right. Between D.L. Hughley and Cedric the Entertainer, that's when that physical music number happened with Steve Harvey. And I know that you have very strong feelings about physical comedy.
Well, yes. I mean, now I can't remember what it was that... Was it you making faces?
It was me making faces.
Yeah. Well, first of all, there's a difference between that and Steve Harvey having a choreographed musical number. You know, I mean,
I am not comparing myself to Steve Harvey, who is a comedy god. I'm just saying you lumped all physical comedy together when you were talking to me about that.
But again, I still believe that because people aren't doing white people do this, black people do that. It was a different time. It wasn't worn out yet. When he stands on that table, if you watch that now, you'd be like, you know, people hump the stool. Joe Rogan is constantly referred to as a stool humper. And people don't like comedians in general. I'm not saying there aren't people out there who wouldn't be like, this is the funniest thing ever. But people who are critical of it think that part of the act is silly and...
Right.
And juvenile.
Okay.
And I stand by that. I think that people would do the same thing. Maybe not the musical act, but definitely like turning the table over and using it as a sailboat or whatever.
I think that Steve Harvey did so much more with his actions than he could have done with words in the same amount of time.
Okay.
That he communicated, and yeah, it was a different sort of communication, but he completely communicated something that would take pages to describe.
Sure. I agree with that. And I think the one that Cedric the Entertainer did was fascinating as well.
Are you talking about the ice skating?
No, I'm talking about the black people flying a space shuttle.
Okay.
I mean, that was like, you know, he compares it to, I can't remember the type of car that he said, but, you know, in the 90s and early 2000s, the cool car for black people would be like a big Cadillac, you know, a car that we would refer to as a boat.
Hoopty.
Yeah, hoopty mobile. And one of you know, he talks about that big ass steering wheel and having to take the turns and almost like you're driving a tractor trailer. You know, he's moving his hand around like Mr. Miyagi, wax on, wax off kind of thing.
My favorite part of that is when he winds down the imaginary window of the space shuttle.
Yeah.
And hollas.
But I don't want to get too far ahead. So was that pretty much the end of the Steve Harvey thing?
Yeah, I think it's perfect time to transition into Cedric the Entertainer.
Okay, so with Cedric, you know what's funny, though? I do think that there were a couple people on the Blue Collar Comedy Tour that one of your criticisms was you didn't remember anything about them.
Their jokes were not memorable to me. They didn't grab me. Yes.
I could probably give you two or three bits from each one of these comedians on the Kings of Comedy. They were very memorable in what they did. I wouldn't even say their styles were, you know, incredibly different, but you just remember who they are by what they're doing. Even though some of it was, you know, everybody, almost all of them had a black people and white people kind of thing.
Not most of them. All of them. I wrote them down. Okay. Because I wanted to remember it. You know what I mean? Like, I wanted to remember that Steve Harvey was white people versus black people in the Titanic. I wanted to remember that D.L. Hughley was the way white people shoot up places when they get fired and black people. And that's not even wrong. I wanted to remember that Cedric the Entertainer talks about white people having hope that things don't go wrong.
Oh, okay. So that bit right there is probably, when we get to Bernie Mac has the most memorable bit for me out of the whole thing. But Cedric the Entertainer saying that, go ahead and saying hope versus
wish.
Right.
He's got hope versus wish. So white people hope things don't go wrong, and black people wish they do.
Right. Because he's talking about there was some white people in the front row, and he's like, y'all showed up early because you were hoping that no one sat in your seats, because white people don't want confrontation. Black people wish a motherfucker would.
Right.
They're like, I pay money for these. I wish a motherfucker would be sitting in my seat. That, to me, this is 23 years, and I still say, I wish a motherfucker would. Thinking back to that, it was just such a memorable line, and it just sticks with you forever.
That was my favorite part of Cedric's set, was that right there. And he opened with it, so he had me.
You know, it's interesting, because they bring him out, and Steve Harvey brings him out as, like, the winner of these different awards. Like, Cedric the Entertainer, there's a reason that's his name. He was, like, the biggest entertainer. He was known for that. So he came out, and you could see why. I mean, he was, I will say Bernie Mac is the best. But it's hard to really say who was the best on this. I mean, Steve Harvey comes out first. That's a hard spot to be in. And then he's going up in between them. And doing time.
Right.
Like, that's incredible to keep the show flowing like that. And D.L. Hughley just, I mean, a monster.
He murdered.
And then Cedric the Entertainer. You know, you watch, you see Cedric and you're like, man, it can't get any better than this.
Well, I mean, I did love them all and I was entertained as hell by all of them. But for me, Cedric was probably my least favorite of the four.
Wow.
I know.
That's because you don't like fat people.
It's true.
That's why this podcast is so difficult.
I'm an obesophobe. Yeah. And in fact, I won't even go see the new movie Whale that's coming out this weekend because it just makes me so uncomfortable.
How is it coming out this weekend? It was in the Oscars for last year.
Well,
is this episode coming out months ago? So why was Cedric your least favorite?
I didn't find him as memorable as the rest of the guys.
Okay.
That's it. Like, I didn't find him, like, boring into my soul or, like, really getting something that pricked me. You know what I mean?
Right.
But I still enjoyed the hell out of him. He just, out of the four, he was my number four.
I mean, look, if you're the fourth best of the Kings of Comedy, you're probably one of the top 10 comedians in the world at that point.
And I'm not saying he's the fourth of the Kings of Comedy. I'm saying, for me, he was
the fourth
on my ranking. You know, I enjoyed him. And I really did enjoy him. Yeah. I enjoyed the other ones more.
Okay.
Which I did not enjoy Bill Engvall's set much at all. So when he was my fourth on the blue collar.
Here's the thing. I think if you're ranking Bill Engvall fourth on the blue collar, he might be in the top 100 at the time. He was not my favorite either. And there might be some people out there that think he's the best or whatever, but it's a different kind of least favorite between him and Cedric. Because again, All the Kings of Comedy murdered.
I agree.
Like I said, it'd be hard for me to say who was the best or whatever, but I get it. You know, comedy is subjective.
For sure. So after Cedric, Steve Harvey came out and he did the thing about church, which I found hilarious.
Okay.
And then Bernie Mac came up.
Here we go. This is, you know, RIP. I was actually getting kind of sad listening to it because it's so good.
He passed in 2008. He was 50 years old.
Yeah. And it's like, man, what more? Because he had started doing some really good movies.
Ocean's 11.
He did a baseball movie called Mr. 3000.
Never saw it.
It's good because he's like a big-time baseball player that's on his way to, that's close to getting like 3,000 hits.
Okay.
You know, it's been a while since I've seen it, but it was very good. And I just think Bernie Mac had a lot more to offer, you know, in the same vein as Patrice O'Neill. You know, I thought, you know, he was another one that just passed too soon. And it's like, man, you know.
So with Bernie Mac, all I remember is that he had pneumonia.
That's how he passed away. It was, I mean, pneumonia, you know.
And I'm not, I mean, that's one of those things that they'll say when it could be so many different diseases, but pneumonia was involved. So I have no idea what the whole story is there, nor do I know why I want to know. It's a person who's passed, and that's the only part that should matter, but yeah. I have this.
I feel like it was probably like a heart disease, like some kind of cardiac arrest that resulted from his body being weak from pneumonia, but I don't know for sure.
That makes sense. So that's a big bummer. Let's get into the good stuff. I love the fact Bernie Mac, he's 42 years old. He's been married 25 years. So I immediately feel like I can relate very strongly to this man in front of me just because we're in the same stage of life.
Right. Only you're older than 42. But you have been married 25 years.
Right. You're 42 and you've been married 1.5 years.
Yep.
So between the two of us, we're a spot on Bernie Mac. So I loved it. He talked about sex as you get older, and he talked about...
You know, he wasn't afraid to say that he wasn't as good at sex anymore, which I thought was...
Refreshing.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's... He didn't do that in his deaf comedy jam. He talked about really, really putting in the work. But apparently a few years later, he's like, I'm so tired.
Yeah, I'm just wore out, man. I don't know if I want to work that hard anymore. And he talked about oral sex, but not in a disgusting way. He talked about a way that made me laugh from beginning to end.
Yeah, it's you know, what I thought was funny is when he said, like, women will act like they're not good at it, so you'll be like, it's fine, just stop. But for him, he's like, nah, I'm, you know, they gotta learn.
Gotta learn somehow. My favorite line from Bernie Mac was, it's jokes, it's fun, but it's also the truth.
Yeah, and you go, you know, if it makes you laugh, you know, it's just funny. We're here to have fun. But the reason he said that, now this to me was the one that was the most, it would never happen right now. Never, ever, 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 ever.
Are you talking about his stuttering nephew?
Nope, which that one was...
Terrible. Like, I mean, it was funny, but...
I find it interesting that that's the one that you found to be the most offensive, because to me, it was what he referred to the four-year-old as.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
You know, he constantly... A homophobic slur that starts with the letter F over and over and over.
Yeah.
I mean, look, here, again, this is the year 2000, 23 years ago. It was still a word that... was offensive, but it did, like, people wouldn't get in trouble for saying it.
I see. And I, at that point in life, I didn't even know that was an offensive word.
I mean, I think I knew that was offensive when I was in elementary school.
You're gifted. No, I really didn't. And I also think that word, it has a very fun sound to it.
It does. I mean, there's a reason that, you know, boys would call their friends that word other than just, you know, gay shaming them. It's like the word fuck. You know, we talked about how certain words in comedy, you have like hard sounding words that fuck starts with a soft F and then ends with a hard K. It triggers something in your brain that, you know, people will tell a joke with the F word, with the word. I'm trying not to say fuck over and over and over again, but they'll tell a joke with that word in it.
Right.
And it will kill. And then they'll tell the same joke without that word, and it doesn't get the same response. So is the joke that they're telling funny, or is that word a triggering word? And it's the same way with the homophobic slur. It is a funny sounding word. It's also funny to think of a 4-year-old behaving in a way that is commonly associated with people as they get older.
It's true. And then that's whether or not it is in a homophobic way or not. I mean, it can just be anything.
Yes.
It can be them worried about the bills would be hilarious.
If you see a 4-year-old acting, a 4-year-old boy being effeminate, it is like, where is he picking this up from? I'm not saying it's bad, but you're like, he must spend a lot of time with his sister or something, you know?
Right.
But I think for sure Bernie Mac referring to him that way, you know, but him saying that, like, right now, Kevin Hart got fired from the Oscars because he tweeted something 10 or 15 years ago. And in fact, when I say who knows what Bernie Mac had to offer, even if he wouldn't have died, we might have never found out.
It's true.
Because people would have just brought this tour up from 20 years ago and been like, he's got to go.
Right.
He said these awful things.
Which is one of the scariest things about pursuing comedy is it seems like everybody can take it the wrong way.
Well, you know, I have a friend who's gay, and we went to eat at a...
What, he won an award?
I want some milk and cookies. No, we went to eat at a restaurant in Seattle, Washington, and the sign outside, it was a place known for its hearty meals, and the sign outside said, no sissy food. And he got upset about that. I didn't realize that sissy was something that was offensive to gay people. Because when I'm watching the Bernie Mac set, I'm wondering, like, if he would have said he's a sissy, I think it would have got a big laugh as well without being as offensive. But again,
I don't know.
My friend didn't like it when they referred to their food not being sissy food. I think people might have considered what Bernie was doing in that set as punching down.
Maybe.
But I think he's just talking about these shitty-ass kids that he's got to raise for his drug-addicted sister.
And then he ended up taking that all the way to the little screen, and the Bernie Mac show was all about that.
You know, that's awesome for him. And I think that it's... I never watched the show.
I watched every episode.
How was he with the kids in the show? Because in the special, he talks about opening up a daycare where he hits a kid in the head with a hammer, and he tells the parents when they come to pick him up, they're like, what happened to his head? And he's like, I hit him in the head with a hammer.
I feel like that's just like you, because you'll sit here and say stuff like, yeah, I just wanted to throw her. And I have never seen you do anything but hug and cuddle and love and dote on your child.
Because I know what will get me arrested.
And I think that's one of those things, too. You know, you talk about, you have talked to me before about what people will tell you as a parent and what people won't tell you. I feel like he is bringing forth everybody's inner dialogue in a way, because it's funny, because we've all had really inappropriate thoughts about our children, perhaps.
I'm going to kill this little asshole. You know, like, it goes through your head. And you know what's interesting is that bit about, and this is the one that I'm saying is the most memorable for me, because, you know, it has always been hilarious. When he talks about that, the little four-year-old coming downstairs, things like, he walks past him like he ain't even there. And he goes, what you doing? And the kid goes, to get some milk and cookies.
I love it.
And he's like, get your punk ass upstairs. And then the little girl comes down, and she it's like she bowed up on him.
I love it.
And he is talking about how these kids are acting shitty.
They're entitled.
And he's ready to bust their ass.
Yeah.
And this was a big thing for him. Louis C.K., he was writing for, I think, Conan, and like he was successful in a way, but he was doing some very bland comedy. And then his special that came out, I think at the time it was on Showtime, and I think it was called Shameless, Louis C.K. talked about how his kids were assholes. And he used that word. He's like, my daughters, they're assholes. And he talked about how shitty it was being a parent. And that was when his career went to another level. And I think it's the same thing with Bernie Mac. These guys are saying things that if you were just talking to your friends about, they'd be like, man, we got to call CPS. But in their head, everyone's like, man, I know, I feel the same way, but you just can't say it out loud. So when these guys go and do it in a comedic way, I think everyone is relating to that and being like, man, I wish I could bust my kid upside the head sometimes, you know? Even though you'll never do it, again, they're saying the thing that you always think as a parent.
He used a phrase in his comedy that I don't understand.
What was that?
First of all, he also used a lot of, dialect or fun ways to say words that I thought made his comedy even more interesting, like milk and cookies. I would love to try to read the transcript of his comedy, though, because he uses a lot of really weird combinations. Anyways, I'd never heard the term smoke in the city.
Smoking, like smoke in the city or yes. Smoking the city?
Smoke in the city.
Okay.
Like, I think it was in reference to going to, like, Big Mama, and she'd be like, they're going to be smoking the city tonight.
Oh, okay. So it's basically saying, like,
there's going to be trouble.
The town's going to be on fire after I'm done with you.
I'm lighting this town up.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure. But that was a new one, like, smoke in the city. The way he said it, it seemed so colloquial, and I had no idea what it meant.
Yeah, it's down, like, you know, when Chicago burnt to the ground,
right?
It was a tragedy. And when she gets done with your ass, it's going to be tragic as well.
So I would have liked a little bit of explanation on the term smoke in the city. Instead, a word that I completely understand, motherfucker, got all the attention.
I will say he did himself a disservice because he referred to the word as a noun. It describes a person, place, or thing. But then when he goes through two black people talking to each other, and you might hear two normal words and the word motherfucker 30 times, he uses it as a noun, an adjective, and an adverb, which I think if he would have said that in the beginning, he would have set it up even more, like how powerful.
Like it can be anything.
Yes.
I'll tell you what, if he were still alive and I were to run into him, I would be sure to teach him how to properly diagram a sentence so that he could identify it in each of its amazing capabilities.
And I know that you would be able to do that because earlier today on the radio, I heard you talking about how in COVID you had to teach your own kids. And you you were talking about a teacher got in trouble for duct taping her student to a chair.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just thinking, I bet if Bernie Mac would have been a teacher, he would have done the same thing.
It's rough, man. Like, I have trouble sometimes keeping my two. I mean, now they're practically adults, so it's not as hard. But I remember when they were, like, in middle school age, I'd be like, how does somebody deal with 25 of these motherfuckers?
which in that way it was being used as a noun.
Mm-hmm. I was doing that for Bernie Mac.
That was great.
Peace, love, and happiness, my friend.
What a nice homage.
So to get everybody up to date, Steve Harvey is 66. We already talked about it. He does the morning show, all the Family Feuds. He does Judge Steve Harvey. He hosts Miss Universe. And
he messed up. He read the wrong person is the winner one year.
He had some issues about making some sort of racial comment about an Asian man.
Yep, which he had to apologize for, and surprisingly has remained successful. So that's interesting.
I will also say one of my favorite things about Steve Harvey, and this is not from the Kings of Comedy special, this is something aside, he talks about the difference between failing and quitting.
Mm-hmm.
And how you reach those crosswords, like how you reach those crossroads.
I fail at a lot of crosswords, and I do eventually quit because it is difficult.
I never even start them. Those things are not meant for me. I cannot spell. I think that's one of the skills you have to have.
But you're going
to
give Bernie Mac an English lesson.
Those two are not the same thing.
I know.
The difference between failing and quitting, and how you sometimes you get to these posts in life and you...
I'm feeling attacked right now.
You have to decide for yourself, is this the point where I am failing or is this the point where I am quitting? And I got to tell you, Wednesday night was really freaking hard for me. Wednesday night was hard for me. It was a comedy contest. I'll explain why I was upset in a little bit, but I was so inside my head that I sat in the parking lot for an hour and a half before I could even drive my car.
Here's the thing. I mean, I want to put it into perspective for you because I said I feel attacked right now. You've been doing comedy for 7 months. First of all, you just shouldn't do competitions. I know that it's fun with the opportunity. I just did one a few months ago in Austin where, once again, like every big competition I've done, I placed in second.
where it was an all or nothing comedy contest.
Yeah. But I mean, the thing to remember is like comedy is so difficult to judge. It's like, why did the guy that beat me win? Like, it, and he won by, you know, 5 votes or whatever out of like 200 people. I got really bummed out about that. But even before that, and, you know, it's kind of difficult to talk about, but the everything that happened with me with America's Got Talent and all this stuff, I hit that crossroad. And I felt like I failed, and I did quit. I know that I'm still going out and doing comedy, you know, once a month or whatever, whenever I can. But I left Los Angeles. I left the Comedy Store, and I gave up on myself. And it, you know, I at the time I gave myself a lot of rationalization on why I was doing it, but you know, a little over a year later, I can definitely say that it was a mistake. And I wish that you would have listened to that prior to me moving to Texas and somehow knew me so that you could have sent that to me, because it is very true. And what you're going through right now, I think every comedian goes through. Luckily, you're still under a year, so you'll push through it. What sucks is when you're 16 years into it and it's the 20th type of thing that makes you feel rejected and not good enough. And that's probably the hardest part about comedy and why so many either commit suicide or overdose on drugs, is that it is a constant feeling of rejection that you have to be able to push past.
When I brought up that Steve Harvey thing about failing versus quitting, it wasn't about you.
It's, oh, no, I know.
But I think it's...
But I have to make everything about me.
I think it's about each and every one of us. And I don't think it's just about comedy. I think it's about so many things in our lives. You know, failing versus quitting, let's say, in a marriage. Failing versus quitting, say, in a job or in comedy.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a sucky couple of days because Wednesday was the comedy competition. And when you do well at something like that, it feels good. And maybe the next morning you wake up and you still feel good going into the beginning of your day.
Mm-hmm.
It sucked. I felt horrible. I went out. I had to sit in the car for an hour and a half before I could even drive, just to kind of get my thoughts together because they were going bad fast. And I was angry by the time I got home. And then I was mad. And then I went to sleep and I woke up and I felt like shit. And I came in to work and I talked to one of my best friends here at the radio station who is a musician. And he's like, he put it in the same context as you did. He said, don't do competitions to win. You do competitions to meet people and to make contacts and to have stage time. He's like, you don't do them to win. And then he went through and he told me people that he beat that went on to have huge, like just blow up careers, and other people that are huge now that lost to people with no names. And that sort of put it a little bit in perspective. And during my time thinking about it, I think the thing that pissed me off the most, the thing that just like got under my skin, was I didn't think the person who won was funny. That's the main problem. This is the thing that just ate my soul, is I'm like, what the hell am I doing in comedy? Here's this 3-panel of judges of people working in comedy, and they're telling me that this is the funniest thing that happened, and I thought it sucked. I thought he got up there and he told stories that did not have a clear ending, did not have any punchlines. It's like more or less he told the premise of something that could be funny if he had put any work into it, but he hadn't. And I'm somewhere way below this person.
Okay, so it's important, and I think I've talked about it before on the podcast. I've definitely talked about it, you know, just in regular conversation. But in this industry, you cannot compare yourself to other people. You cannot compare other people's success to your, because it will drive you crazy. And I understand exactly how you feel. The guy that beat me in that competition was the corniest act ever.
He's wacky.
Yeah.
His whole comedy is wacky. I don't know how else to describe him. But yeah, like, that was the thing that I thought was upsetting me is like, well, how can I even continue in comedy if I can't even see what was funny about what they're saying is the winner? And then I started realizing it's not that. It's that I, like every person who's gotten into comedy, needs affirmation, and I don't feel affirmed.
I mean, you...
I didn't go there expecting to win or wanting to win, but like none of the judges said good job or I'm liking the new material or anything that was in any way positive or encouraging. So I've come to realize that I may say things like I don't need that, I'm doing it for me, but it's not true. I need that.
I mean, that's why we do it. Who would get on stage and try and make people laugh without needing for the people to laugh?
The closest it came to any kind of affirmation, and I may be undervaluing it because I was already spinning out of control, was last month a dude named Israel won the competition, and there were only 9 people in the competition instead of 10 this month. They got up there and they said, well, obviously the funniest person was Israel, but you can't win 2 months in a row. So it goes to this other guy. Okay. So I already know out of 9 people, at the very best, I'm going to come in third.
Mm-hmm.
On the way out, Israel was like, hey, we need to share more stages together. And I'm just like, yeah, I'm totally down for that. And that was the nicest thing because... I mean, he was saying, I dig what you do in his own way.
Yeah. Also, don't forget, for you, Cedric the Entertainer was the 4th best out of 4 comedians, and he's still hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
So just because you were 3rd best.
I don't think I was, though.
But if that's where you were, because you finished 2nd to me.
Yeah, you know, and I've been thinking back on that, and I don't think that's right either. I mean, when I think back about our sets, I think you blew me out of the water.
I mean, they had to have the audience clap, because it went to a tiebreaker where the audience voted through noise, and they had to get the audience to do it twice just so they could determine who was better. But that's beside the point. The fact is, I guarantee you Israel wasn't going up and doing... brand new material. I guarantee, you know, it is an open mic contest, but these people aren't doing open mic sets. They're doing stuff that they've prepared, you know? And so you are taking this way more seriously as a career than most of them are because you are being prolific. You may not be proficient every time.
That's true.
But you are being prolific. You are writing constantly, and you're putting up new material constantly. You are taking this seriously, and I think that's the most important thing. Whether or not you ever win a contest, it's important to know that you are like treating this like a job.
I wish that contest had some sort of judges sheet that you got back that listed sort of like the areas that they're looking for and kind of where you're at. Like you're in the mid-range on this one, you're a little low on this one, you're high on this one, so that you knew kind of where you needed to improve. I think that would be helpful for everybody. And then like at the end, they had said, they made this big point of, hey, the name of the contest is to fill the 5 minutes. And if you didn't fill the 5 minutes, then you're automatically dinged a ton. There's no clock. My mic died somewhere into my set.
That's like the second. Yeah, that happens a lot there, huh?
I'm not sure if they restarted my time when the mic change happened because I'd already done some material before the mic change happened.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if, you know, if that was me, if I didn't fill my whole 5 minutes because there's no feedback. Yeah, and of course, I've thought about it all way too much. Like, I have given way too much of my brain computing power.
You're obsessing over it.
I'm not impressed with my handling of this. I'm not impressed with where my mind is at right now with this. I already feel like the oddball because this is all men and I'm the only woman. Mm-hmm. And not only am I the only woman, I'm 47 fucking years old.
Yeah.
And I already feel outside. And I don't know if it was out of comedy or what, but Like 2 weeks ago today, I was at an event and one of the guys introduced me as this is this old lady that we let hang around with us. And I don't know if he was trying to be funny or what the fuck it was, but number one, I'm the same age as two of the other members of the group within a couple of years. And like, I feel like maybe there's not it for me here. You know what I mean? Like that here, I'm always going to be thought of as an outsider or an outlier. And I think what makes me an outsider or an outlier are my strongest things comedically. Mm-hmm. The things that make me different from all these motherfuckers makes my material different from all the material of these motherfuckers.
Like the old lady. I had a friend that I quit a podcast with because he just continuously talked shit about me. And I was, at the time, I had more followers, more fans. And I was like, dude, I'm bringing something to this. If you continue to talk shit about me on this podcast, like, I get it, you're trying to be funny, but you're pissing me off.
Right.
And I quit the podcast because I brought... Like, my friend Adam that passed away, he bought me the laptop. He bought me the soundboard. Like, he was paying to produce this thing. And then they, you know, this guy was, like, constantly being a shithead. And I just was, I took my ball and I went home. Because, like, I'm not going to bring all this to the thing when what you're doing is, like, hurting me.
Right.
Eventually, it got to the point where I was drunk one night at the Comedy Store, and I just started yelling at him and telling him what a fucking asshole he was. And then that actually sunk in, you know? I didn't want to have a battle of wits every time because you're calling me fat. You're being mean about it, and it just doesn't stop over and over and over. And then, like, I can only say that you got molested by your uncle enough where until it's like, man, Mitch is being very insensitive about the fact that his uncle touched him. You know, I get it. Like, you know, you're an older woman, and if that's what they're going to say to, like, in their mind, playing around, it's like, fucking, like, don't treat me differently. That, you know, I'm part of the group. It don't put me down.
That's my whole thing is like, am I part of the group or am I just allowed to be there? That's really what it comes down to it for me. Like, am I really part of the group or is what they said true? Am I some old lady they let hang around with them?
Well, I don't know. You know, I've pushed this on you a few times. If you want to advance, you need to produce your own show.
Okay.
And then you can put the people that you want to put on your show. We can bring people up from Dallas or down from Oklahoma City.
I think we should produce a show in Dallas.
I just got a thing that I'm doing at the Dallas Comedy Club, and if it goes good, I'll be able to continue doing it.
What is it?
I'm doing a themed show called Carbon Copy, and that's where I have comedians do a set, and then they're, like, paired up,
uh-huh.
And then they do each other's set, and they either dress like them or act like or whatever. It's something similar that I did in Seattle that somebody else produced, and I just think it's a really fun type of show. So I'm doing one as a test, and if it goes well, you know, hopefully I'll be able to continue doing it.
That's interesting. I think the other opportunity is Red Room shows because you pay money for the actual room and then you keep tickets.
Yeah. What's difficult about that is, you know, you just want a venue where people are going to be coming. A lot of those places where you rent the room, they depend solely on you renting the room and then you depend solely on getting the ticket sales.
Right.
So it's just kind of difficult to do that. But...
So you're saying that it's not like a balanced split for promotion?
Yeah, I just think it's harder. But again, I'm a real... it's just not something that I've ever enjoyed doing. But look, I get it. You think Dallas would be better. But I'm telling you, you have a built-in advertisement system here where you're on the radio. You know the area. You've lived here for years. There's got to be a place that you think would be cool. The guy who just bought the High Dive, he's reached out to me about doing comedy there somehow.
Interesting.
But it's at an outdoor venue. But there's a pavilion that they're going to enclose. So we talked about maybe doing that. But regardless, I think that it's possible to do comedy around here because what you need is a space to develop and grow. But you also want to cultivate your own audience. You would be able to book it yourself, to run it however you wanted to, and promote it yourself and get people out there to see the show. And I think that would work perfect. You could host it. You could have somebody else host it. You do it however you want to do. You got to be willing to pay some people some money to come up from Dallas and perform if you want it to be good. I still think, you know, from one of the previous episodes where your task was to find a venue to let you do some comedy, I think you really need to pursue that some more. I've pursued it. I've talked to the Maplewood. I've talked to the Backdoor Theater, and I've talked to this other guy, and I went to Half Pint because they have a big venue in the back. And, you know, the Maplewood, the Backdoor, they've gotten back to me, and, you know, I'm trying to see what I can do. And the guy from the High Dive reached out to me.
That's encouraging.
So there's an opportunity there. But I think you should really be doing this as well, because I think you take it more seriously than some of these other people. And I think that you have a lot of potential to surpass them. And your age doesn't matter. And your gender doesn't matter. It's just you got to be funny and you got to work at it. And I think that you do that more than a lot of people.
Cool. Hey.
Yeah. We are.
Yeah.
Still.
Always.
Stuck.
In.
Texas.
Yep. Yeehaw.
Yeah, go ahead. You got to go answer the door. Mm-hmm. This studio needs a button like Matt Lauer's office.